From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, novelist Francine Prose. Her new book, Blue Angel, echoes the classic Marlene Dietrich film in which a German teacher becomes infatuated with a showgirl. In Prose's version, a creative writing professor falls for his talented student, giving Prose the chance to explore university politics, sexual harassment, and political correctness on campus. Also, singer-songwriter and guitarist Alex Chilton. As a teenager, he recorded hits with the Box Tops. Later, his songwriting earned him the status of cult figure. Now he has a new CD covering other people's songs. And critic Maureen Corrigan reads a sobering letter from the Social Security Administration about the benefits she'll receive when she retires. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Miami's embattled city manager, Donald Warshaw, whose own job is in jeopardy, said today he's picked a Cuban-American city official to be the city's first-ever Hispanic police chief. NPR's Philip Davis has more from Miami.
Raul Martinez is Warshaw's pick for Miami's top law enforcement officer. Born in Cuba, Martinez came to the U.S. as a child. He is currently assistant city manager for the city of Miami. Martinez will replace outgoing police chief William O'Brien. O'Brien retired last week, saying city mayor Joe Carollo was playing divisive ethnic politics in the wake of a federal raid April 22nd that extracted 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez from the city and reunited him with his father. City manager Warshaw may be on his way out, too, after Carollo fired him in the wake of the Elian Gonzalez raid. Despite the fact that he only has a week to go on his job, Warshaw still has the power to appoint a new chief, who now cannot be fired by the mayor. A furious mayor now says he's launching a criminal investigation of Warshaw's administration. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
5 nuclear nations, including the United States, have renewed an old promise to eliminate their nuclear weapons, but they didn't say when. The nations, the U.S., Russia, China, France, and Britain, issued a joint statement at the United Nations headquarters in New York, reaffirming their support for the treaty and supporting negotiations for other disarmament efforts. The treaty, which has been in effect since 1970, requires the 5 nations to disarm while barring non-nuclear nations from acquiring atomic weapons. Arms control groups complained that the 5 nations haven't taken any substantive action to eliminate nuclear weapons. Families of the victims of the Pan Am 103 Lockerbie bombing are heading for a former U.S. military base in the Netherlands to attend a trial that begins this week. 2 Libyans are charged with the murder of 189 passengers, crew, and townspeople of Lockerbie, Scotland. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Utrecht.
Amid intense security and the world media, a 12-year wait is about to reach a climax, but it too will be painstakingly slow in coming. Prosecutors will present a case of more than 1,000 witnesses in a courtroom that is a converted U.S. airbase. The trial and the special imprisonment of the 2 Libyans charged with the bombing is expected to cost some $100 million over the next year. The prosecution will begin its case Wednesday by first establishing that a crime was committed. Early witnesses include aviation experts and police who sifted through the Pan Am 103 wreckage. The defense is expected to blame Palestinian terrorists, the same group that was the U.S. government's chief case until the Libyan connection was made. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Utrecht.
The Dow gained 78 points to close at 10,812. This is NPR. Cuban President Fidel Castro led hundreds of thousands of Cubans today in a May Day rally in Havana, where he called for the return of 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez. Castro spoke briefly by cell phone with Elian's father, with whom the boy is now living at a rural retreat in Maryland. The Cuban president said Juan Miguel Gonzalez thanked the demonstrators for their support. Castro said Elian has been kept in the U.S. by the efforts of what he called a Cuban-American terrorist mob. Michigan prosecutors have arraigned a man charged with providing the weapon allegedly used by a 6-year-old to kill another first grader. Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET has more.
19-year-old Jamel James appeared in a Flint, Michigan courtroom to be arraigned on an involuntary manslaughter charge. He's accused of allowing a 6-year-old to find a handgun hidden in his bedroom. Both were staying at the house of the boy's uncle. The 6-year-old took that gun to a classroom at the Buell Elementary School in Mount Morris Township on February 29th, where he shot and killed 6-year-old Kayla Rolland. No charges were filed against the boy because of his age, but prosecutors say they traced the .32 caliber pistol back to James. Officers found a stolen shotgun, ammunition, and drugs in the house where James, the 6-year-old, and his older brother lived. James pleaded not guilty to the involuntary manslaughter charge. A trial date has been set for July 11th. For NPR News, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
Passengers flying into the Dallas-Fort Worth airport face a boycott by taxi drivers who are protesting new rules that require newer cabs and daily inspections. The new regulations say drivers must prove that they can speak English and read a map, and they must accept credit cards. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Francine Prose, is a novelist, book reviewer, and cultural critic. Her recent New York Times Magazine piece, A Wasteland of One's Own, was about the paradoxes of the new women's culture, from the Oxygen Network to iVillage and Bridget Jones' Diary. It sounds great, she says, culture by and for women, but the content reinforces all the old stereotypes. In a recent edition of Harper's, she wrote about how American high school students learn to loathe literature. In her new novel, Blue Angel, she takes on university politics and political correctness. Reviewing it in the Washington Post, Michael Derda described it as among the most enjoyable books he's read in a long time. The main character, Ted Swenson, is a 47-year-old professor of creative writing who wrote a well-received novel early in his career but can't make any progress writing his current one. He's feeling increasingly alienated from his students with their piercings and tattoos, but he's lured into an affair with a student and ends up facing sexual harassment charges. Here's a reading from an early scene.
The scene begins at a college-wide meeting. This is a small college, Houston College in Vermont. And the dean has, Dean Bentham, has convened the entire faculty to remind them of the college's sexual harassment policy because there's been a sort of controversial case in a nearby college, and he wants to make sure that none of his faculty will make the same mistake. So he reads the policy. No Houston College faculty member shall have sexual relations with a currently enrolled or former student, nor offer to trade sexual favors for academic advancement. And then we go into the head of my hero, Swenson, who's listening. Puritanism's alive and well. Thank God for repression. What if someone rose to say what so many of them are thinking, that there's something erotic about the act of teaching, all that information streaming back and forth like some bodily fluid? Doesn't Genesis trace sex to that first bite of apple? Not the fruit from just any tree, but the tree of knowledge. Teacher-student attraction is an occupational hazard. Over the years, plenty of girls have had crushes on Swenson. He's not flattering himself about this. It's built into the system. Still, their interest is flattering, which in itself is attractive, and so their attention was sometimes returned in ways that couldn't have been more harmless. So what if he read Miss A's paper first or looked to see if Miss B got his joke? More often than not, those students worked harder and learned more. And those fleeting attachments never led any further. Swenson should be canonized. He's the saint of Houston. As hard as it might be for anyone, including himself, to believe, he's taught for 20 years and never once slept with a student. He loves Sherry, his wife. He wants his marriage to last. He's always felt shy around women, nor has he needed the dean to point out the moral implications of the power gap between teacher and student. So he'd managed to get past those awkward spots with literary talk. Each friendly, formal, professorial chat layered a barrier between him and the problematically attractive student until neither of them could have begun to dismantle that protective partition. By then it was way too late, too embarrassing and daunting to face each other on any other terms, as male and female, for example. But what the dean's saying is that nothing has to happen. Any spark can set off the tinderbox of gender war. Best not to make eye contact or shake a student's hand. Every classroom's a lion's den, every teacher a Daniel. And every Tuesday afternoon, Swenson's job requires him to discuss someone's tale of familial incest and fumbling teenage sex with the college's most hypersensitive and unbalanced students, some of whom simply despise him for reasons he can only guess. He's the teacher, and they're not. Or he looks like somebody's father.
Thanks for reading that, Francine Prose, and that's from Francine Prose's new novel, Blue Angel. Now, what inspired you to put yourself in a male professor's position? Having written a lot about women, essays and fiction, during your career, you'd think in a way that you'd be writing from a woman's point of view, especially about a subject as charged as sexual harassment.
For one thing, I found it tremendously liberating to write from a male point of view. Just on the simplest technical level, you can call a male character by his last name. I mean, it still is possible to say Swenson did this, Swenson did that, whereas in fact, when you're writing about a female character, it's very rare, you almost never see a writer saying, you know, Jones got up in the morning and brushed her hair. So that gives you a certain distance on the character, and I wanted that kind of distance here on my main character. Also, I was basing it on The Blue Angel, I mean, the Marlene Dietrich film, and the professor was a male, and I thought, well, let's just make the professor a male and see what happens.
I'm wondering if writing from a male point of view is a good exercise for you in the sense that you're getting into, you know, your male character's point of view and not just having a kind of blanket response of men are sexual harassers, women are the ones who get harassed.
Oh, yeah. The thing is that was amazing for me was how sympathetic I felt for this guy and how deeply, you know, as, I mean, I really, you know, Swenson, c'est moi. After about two chapters, I felt so close to this guy and all his kind of embarrassing, impermissible, outrageous thoughts were my embarrassing, impermissible, outrageous thoughts. I mean, his response at that tedious faculty dinner party. I've been to that dinner party. I was that guy at that dinner party. So it was easy. And then really kind of as a extra benefit, it gave me the ability to reverse those traditional roles of, you know, the victimizing male harasser and the innocent female student. I mean, that's not what's happening here. But I should say that wasn't my intention. When I started out, I really wanted to do a love story. I mean, I wasn't thinking I'm going to sit down now and write a novel about sexual harassment. I thought I'm going to do this novel. I'm going to think about Blue Angel, and I'm going to think about obsessional love and how it can ruin your life. And I thought, well, I'll set it in a college classroom. I've been spending a certain amount of time in these classrooms. And the next thing I knew, I realized what universe I was writing about. And I thought, you know, if this happened in this atmosphere, here is what would happen. It would be a particular kind of mess, and he would ruin his life in a particular kind of way.
And, I mean, I hope I'm not giving away too much here, but the student who he has the relationship with, he has no clue to quite how troubled she is and quite how manipulative she's being and really what a liar she is, too. So she really initiates this relationship, although he's the one who's found guilty.
Yeah, I didn't either, to tell you the truth. I mean, as I was writing the novel, you know, one of the great pleasures for me of writing fiction is that you don't know where it's going. Mm-hmm. I mean, some writers, I think, have things planned out. I don't, and I just write from sentence to sentence and chapter to chapter and hope for the best. And I had no idea that Angela Argo, the student, would turn out to be the kind of person she turns out to be. And as each sort of upsetting and progressively more horrible revelation came about, I felt almost as if I were watching this train wreck. I was going, oh, my God, that's what she's doing. That's what she's going to do.
Writer Francine Prose is my guest. Her new novel is called Blue Angel. You know, one of the teachers in your novel says, we all have to watch our backs now. I never talk to a female student in my office alone without the door wide open, and I keep a tape recorder in my desk that I can activate if things get dicey. Has it come to that?
Yeah. It absolutely has. I mean, those are not much in this novel actually happened or is based on life, but those are things I've heard from friends, male friends, colleagues, teachers. They do keep tape recorders in their desks and they do keep the door open. And you know, sometimes I have to tell you that I've heard these sorts of statements from these sort of very sweet, very elderly man. And part of me thinks, you know, in your dreams, this is going to be the problem that you're mentioning. But in fact, I think that they're right to be worried. I mean, you know, their horror, and I don't think that they're so far wrong, as it'll reach the point that you have to have kind of the nurse present at the student conference the way you do at the visit to the doctor's office.
What's your critique of sexual harassment codes at universities now?
Well, I think the old days when it was perfectly normal and acceptable and no one really said much for usually male professors to have affairs with female students was pretty bad. I mean, I think it was bad for the students. It was just bad for the atmosphere. And what's rarely talked about, I mean, of course there was an unequal power relation. It was very bad for the young woman involved, but it was also, you know, having been in classes where it was clear, as a student, where it was clear that that was going on, it was very bad for the morale of the other class. I mean, the other students are thinking, you know, what are we, chopped liver? I mean, why, you know, what? And then any pretense of fairness, that there's actually a grading system that's just based on merit, goes right out the window. So I think that was really excessive and that there were wrongs that needed to be addressed and taken care of. But I do think that it's gone much too far in the other direction, because now, as everybody knows, I guess, it's really begun to influence free speech issues. I mean, it's crept over. It's not just about having affairs with students. It's about, you know, you tell some lame, dirty joke in front of your class, and the next thing you know, your job's on the line. I also think that it's not particularly good for women. It's not good for young women, for their image of themselves. You know, I mean, the way they behave as if women, college-age women, were these kind of frail Victorian flowers who would just be totally, you know, withered by hearing one slightly dirty word from their professor. How can that possibly help women to be seen that way and to see themselves that way?
My guest is Francine Prose. Her new novel is called Blue Angel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Francine Prose. Her new novel is called Blue Angel. Because your professor is an English teacher, you know, you have sessions in which a student has to read their short story out loud and then the other students critique it. And some of these sessions are really pretty funny in your book, and I'm sure you've led a lot of these critique sessions yourself. What are some of the things that go on in critique sessions that you find either particularly funny or embarrassing or disturbing in terms of how students critique each other's mm-hmm. writing?
Well, you know, one of the things that comes up in the very first chapter is someone says or thinks of saying, why don't you rewrite the story from the dog's point of view? I mean, you hear that sort of thing, and you hear yourself saying that sort of thing. Just, I mean, it's an odd process. I mean, there's something, I think, ever so slightly sadistic about the process. I mean, about the whole idea of sitting there with your work, you know, your heart and soul really kind of laid out on this table, and then all these strangers or near strangers talking about it. You know, it's very, very difficult. I mean, like Swenson, I've reached the point where I'm almost always over-identified with the student whose work is being discussed, and I'm just sitting there in agony, even if the student is doing a perfectly good job and is quite resilient about it. I mean, you just hear, you know, the other thing I think that happens is that there are various taboos in the workshop. I mean, and the strongest taboo, I think, the thing you can't say is, I was interested or I was bored, which seem to me the most basic things about writing. I mean, the thing, you know, when I myself am writing, what I'm hoping and praying is it's not boring, don't let it be boring, I'm rewriting it so it's not boring. But when you're teaching, you're not allowed to say that. So instead, there's a whole kind of vocabulary of euphemism that's grown up to avoid having to say the word boring. So people say, you know, you're showing and not telling, or you're telling and not showing, or what's the stakes for these characters, or whose story is it? You know, a number of sort of formulaic responses that just gets around the issue of, you know, I was reading your story and I went to the refrigerator 20 times because it was what I'd rather do.
So do you think that these student critiques are worth doing, or do they just cause a lot of pain without helping much?
I think you can teach students. I mean, I don't think these classes are worthless at all. There's value. You can teach students to edit themselves. You can teach them, and I think the students find it helpful because for students, really, it's sort of the equivalent of publication. I mean, you're putting your work out there, and you're seeing how people do respond in ways that that can be helpful. I mean, when I didn't take so many workshops. I took a few workshops, I guess, when I was a senior in college and junior in college. And what is very helpful is that something that's very, very clear to you can be not clear to another person. You've rewritten it a million times. Let's say you even cut it out of a story. And in your mind, it's always there whether you cut it or not. So, you know, when another student says, I didn't understand that, that can be extraordinarily helpful. On the other hand, frankly, if I had to redesign the whole system, I would go in there and do all of that in conference with the student, and then we just talk about literature during those 2 hours.
There's a scene in the book where the student who the teacher has fallen in love with is reading her story out loud. Now, the mm-hmm. teacher thinks that this is really brilliant. This is part of the reason why he's fallen in love with her, or that he admires her writing so much. The students all think the writing is awful.
Uh-huh.
Who's right?
He is. I mean, comparatively. You know, I should tell you that that Angela's novel that she's writing is actually a novel I started about 5 years ago and gave up because it just seemed not very good to me, and I thought, this isn't going anywhere. So I just put it in a drawer. And then when I needed a novel for Angela to have written or to be writing, I thought, wait a second, I have this novel somewhere, and I rooted around through my drawer, and I found it. And, you know, it's funny when you're writing, the sort of strange coincidences and things you didn't plan. It didn't occur to me while I was looking for Angela's novel or my novel or whoever it was, that it was about an affair between a teacher and a student. I mean, it just so happened that that's what it was about. And I thought, oh, my God, how perfect. I never would have planned it. So I don't think that Angela's novel is a great novel. On the other hand, it's so much, so much better than what the other students are writing. I mean, part of the fun of writing the book was, I have to say, writing their stories, a number of which were just so hilariously bad that it was just exhilarating. I mean, I'd be sort of writing it and giggling at the same time. And, you know, there was an element of, I won't say payback, but certainly, you know, after years and years and years of reading really bad stories, to be able to write one and have everybody talk about it in a scene in my novel was just thrilling. I just thought, okay, it's all worth it.
Can you read a few lines of one of the really bad student submissions?
Yeah. All right. This is a story written by one of the students named Courtney Alcott, who's kind of a Boston Brahmin, a young woman from Boston, old family. And she's written a story called First Kiss, Inner City Blues. And she begins to read, quote, "The summer heat sat on the hot city streets, making it hard for it to breathe, especially Lydia Sanchez. Lydia sat on the filthy, garbage-laden front steps of her brownstone tenement home, watching kids play in the gutter and the water rushing out of a broken fire hydrant. Just yesterday, she used to be one of those kids, but she wasn't now. Lydia was miserable. That morning, she'd yelled at her mother and hit her baby brother. Then she felt even worse. She was used to the crime-ridden, drug-infested city streets of her neighborhood. She didn't let any of that get to her anymore, but this time was different."
What would be your critique of that?
My real critique or the critique that I would be allowed to say? I mean, my real critique
would
be...
Why don't you compare them? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, in fact, the thing that you're trying not to say is, why are you writing this? Why is this the thing you want to write? Certainly there's something you know about that you can do a better job. Maybe you should consider just letting it go and starting all over again. But in fact, you rarely say that. So you say what actually Angela says in the novel, which is more detail, more specificity. You don't say crime-ridden city street. You try and make that street come alive. You try and talk about what's on the street. You know, you try and make the reader see that street. So I guess that isn't actually a bad critique. And if other students who are what do I want to say, more naturally gifted than poor Courtney in this class can take that sort of advice and apply it to their own work, then that's actually very useful.
And of course, there's like no verb, been, noun, agreement, and all that in that first or second sentence. Yeah,
forget it.
How much do you deal with grammar when you're doing a critique session?
Oh, absolutely, completely. I mean, when I'm talking to a student in conference, we go over it word by word, line by line, because frankly, I think that's the only useful and the most useful way to talk about any of this. I mean, the fact is, the other problem with going to class is students say things like, you know, I wanted to know more about her mother and father. I wanted to know more about what happened before the story begins. What about the backstory? Whereas I think really what I want to talk about is language, is how the thing is written, is why, how a sentence can be improved, because you can have all the motivation and all the psychological information you want, but the tools we're working in, you know, are language and sentences and paragraphs, and that's what's important. And that's, unfortunately, what's more rarely talked about in classes.
You know, when the student Angela reads her story out loud in Swenson's class, one of the things she's critiqued for is not writing in a believable voice. All the other students in the class feel like, look, Angela's still a teenager, and this is not written in a teenager's voice. Teenagers don't speak this way. I'm wondering how you deal with that as a teacher. You know, teenagers really have their own language and their own way of speaking. Do you expect them to write in that voice or to write in a voice that doesn't have a lot of likes in it?
Well, of course, writing isn't speaking. So yeah, I'll take the likes out, certainly. But what I've found is that teenagers actually have great ways of using the language. I mean, when they're speaking, when they're writing, they really have this kind of fresh approach to language. And in fact, if you can get them, you know, I've gone into school, into high schools and junior high schools, not as a full semester teacher, but to do day-long workshops and stuff. And what I found is if somehow you can get them to be more free rather than less free, I mean, you know, really kind of express themselves and use language on the page the way they use language with each other, they're much more inventive than if they think they have to write that sort of, whatever they think they have to write for English class, that kind of denatured, stripped down, you know, textbook kind of language, which isn't their language. I mean, so much of writing is about, really is about voice, about what you sound like, what you think like, and finding a way to get that onto the page with the fewest possible barriers.
Well, Francine Prose, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Francine Prose is the author of the new novel, Blue Angel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From lawyers.com, an online legal resource for finding a lawyer and information about the law. AOL keyword lawyers.com. And from Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope, by Jonathan Kozol. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, a surprising new turn for singer-guitarist and songwriter Alex Chilton, a new CD featuring his covers of other people's songs. We're listening to it now. And our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, receives a letter from the Social Security Administration about her benefits when she retires and considers what it reveals about how work is valued or undervalued. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's the measure of a human life? Commentator Maureen Corrigan says that if the Social Security Administration is to be believed, much of her life can be measured in the low four figures.
My life flashed before my eyes last week, and it wasn't a pretty sight. No, I didn't have a near-death experience. I had a sobering brush with bureaucracy. I received one of those letters from the Social Security Administration notifying me that I've finally earned enough work credits to be eligible for benefits when I retire. My first reaction was gratitude. Good old Franklin Roosevelt, what a wonderful president he was for ensuring that we Americans will enjoy some measure of security in our old age. Then I looked at page 2 of the letter, which spelled out the monthly benefits I could expect to receive depending on when I retire. It's dispiriting to realize that in my twilight years, I'll be returning to the lifestyle I enjoyed as a young graduate student. Dinner most nights will once again be a box of macaroni and cheese, and I'll be eating it in the group house I'll no doubt be sharing with a bunch of other depressed people in the same situation. Except this time round, the line for the bathroom in the morning will move a lot more slowly. But that vision of the future wasn't even the grimmest thing about this letter. Far worse was the implied message that my country, the land of opportunity and optimism, had stopped believing in my potential to better myself. The letter said my projected retirement benefits were based on my current earnings. So tactfully, Social Security was informing me it thought I had topped out as a wage earner. How could this have happened to me? As the letter detailed, I've been working since junior high, and if the lasting payoff of all those jobs, especially the early ones I held in my working life, can't be calculated in dollars, what was their worth? That's when I looked at the chart entitled Your Earnings Record at a Glance, and the Social Security ghost of jobs past escorted me on a journey back, back to the land of the time card. 1971, the first year for which I've got a recorded salary, $327. That was probably for a series of summer temp jobs filing in offices. Just thinking about those jobs makes the seconds crawl by. I'd read Dickens' David Copperfield in junior high, and I remember identifying with all the grandiosity and earnestness of youth, with David's despair as he toiled in that infamous blacking factory. There were lots of soul-numbing jobs like that. Cashier at Cress's 5 and 10, grader for the Educational Testing Service, which was the closest I ever came to prostitution, even if it was only intellectual prostitution. Then there were other early jobs that are memorable because they crystallize a time, or for better or worse, they taught me what? Something. There was the job I had as a sales girl in the Husky Boys department at Macy's. It seared into my memory, not because of the job itself, but because of what I had to do to get it. The personnel officer told me when I applied that I didn't qualify as Macy's material because my face was too broken out. She said that if I came back the following week and my acne had cleared up, I'd be hired. So after a week of slathering on the Clearasil, I did go back to present my face for inspection and got the job. Ugh, there's all the humiliation of late adolescence wrapped up in that $1,951 windfall from 1977. My yearly total for 1978 reads zero. So I must have been paid under the table for my job as a camp counselor in the Catskills. That was my first intense multicultural experience. The place had formerly been an Orthodox Jewish camp, and the cooks still worked there, churning out daily meals of kasha and bananas and sour cream for the uncomprehending campers, who were all deaf, underprivileged Black and Hispanic kids. So maybe it's no wonder that given this haphazard work history, when I got to graduate school, I was attracted to the writings of the great 19th century English artist and socialist, William Morris. In his utopian fantasy, News from Nowhere, Morris envisioned a society without money, where everyone devoted themselves to work that engaged their minds and hearts. As somebody who's wound up teaching and writing for an underpaid living, I've been lucky enough to find that kind of work. The reward of labor is life, says one of Morris's characters in News from Nowhere. Is that not enough? According to this letter from Social Security, it looks like it's going to have to be.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, singer-songwriter and guitarist Alex Chilton. As a teenager, he sang lead on the hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. Now he's revered for his own songs. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the lead singer of the group The Box Tops, Alex Chilton had a number one hit at the age of 16 with the 1967 record The Letter. The Box Tops also had a big hit with Cry Like a Baby. Chilton left the group in 1969. He formed his own band, Big Star, which mostly recorded his own songs. Although his songs haven't become hits, they have earned him the status of cult figure. Many singer-songwriters have been inspired by his songs. The Replacements even recorded a song called Alex Chilton. Now Chilton is paying tribute to some of his favorite songs and songwriters on his new CD, Set. It features his covers of rock and roll, soul, and jazz records. We talked with Chilton about the Box Tops a few years ago on Fresh Air. We invited him back with his guitar to talk about his latest work. Chilton now lives in New Orleans, which, like his hometown of Memphis, has a rich music history. Let's hear Lipstick Traces, a song from Chilton's new CD, which was written by Alan Toussaint, one of the major figures in early New Orleans rock and roll.
Your pretty brown eyes, your wavy hair, I won't go home no more, 'cause you're not there. I've got it bad, like I told you before. I'm so in love with you. Don't leave me no more.
Alex Chilton, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
Now, you're really known as a songwriter in addition to a performer. Why did you want to do an album of other people's songs?
Well, I hadn't been writing anything for a few years, and I don't know, it was time to do a record, and the band was hot, and we had a lot of fresh material that that I thought would go well for a record.
How did you put together the set list for your new CD, Set? How did you narrow down what songs you wanted to do?
I guess maybe eight of them I intended to do when we got to the studio. I sort of had a list of things that some of them were just obscure, great tunes. Some of them not so obscure, but interesting for one reason or another. And then while we were in the studio doing the thing, I mean, we recorded the thing all in one night because we knew all the material backwards and forwards, and it's sort of more interesting. It's more lively to just do it live, I think. Then as we recorded these things, other things from our repertoire occurred to us that the musicians would sometimes suggest or would just occur to me that I hadn't really premeditated doing on the session. And so, you know, four or five of the tunes from the record were just things that one of us suggested off the tops of our heads.
You grew up in Memphis, just a real capital for both black music and white music, black performers and white performers. And I'm wondering if there was any place for you as a listener when you were growing up that was off limits to you racially, or if you could go to concerts in black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods, black performers and white performers.
Yeah, there was nothing off limits. In fact, the first concert I ever attended was Bobby Bland, Jackie Wilson, B.B. King, and many more. And I don't know how many white people were there. I think I was 12 or 13 years old, and I went alone, and it was no problem.
Let's play a track from the new CD that relates to your years growing up in Memphis. Is there any song on here that was performed by someone from Memphis or produced at a Memphis studio?
Well, yeah, the first tune on the record, what's it called? I've Never Found a Girl, the Eddie Floyd song, was recorded there at Stax.
And what did the song mean to you when you were young?
Oh, not so much. It's something that I became more of a fan of later. In the last few years, I've become big on that record.
Tell me why and why you lead your new CD with it.
Well, a friend of mine suggested that I do the tune, and it was something I'd never much thought about. And as I watched her groove to it, I realized that maybe it would be a good thing. And we just started doing it live, and it was just completely fun. And so that's sort of how it happened for me.
Why don't we hear it? And this is Never Found a Girl, featuring Alex Chilton on voice and guitar from his new CD, Set. That's Alex Chilton from his new CD, Set. Now, I know when you were growing up, your father was a jazz musician. What did he play? What was his instrument?
Well, he was, before I was born, back in the 30s, he was a sax player in Mississippi and, you know, played with some big bands and smaller bands and that sort of thing. But he didn't make his living playing music in my lifetime. And by the time I was born, he was playing mostly piano. In fact, almost completely.
Did you grow up listening to jazz, and do you feel like that's like one of the essential parts of your like early musical vocabulary?
Yeah. The first records I became interested in were in his jazz collection.
Well, you do some jazz standards on the new CD. I thought we'd hear your version of April in Paris, obviously inspired by the Count Basie version of it. Did your father have the Basie version of April in Paris in his collection?
He did, and Count Basie would come through town all the time, and my dad always tried to get me to go with him to see Count Basie, and I could never, at the time, you know, I was, in those days, I was a rock fan, and I couldn't see the beauty of Basie at all, and I never went with him to see him. But as the years went by, I began to get the picture. And so after, I guess somewhere in the last few years, I became fascinated with April in Paris and Chinese Stockings and those things, and sort of worked them out on the guitar. And so there they are on the record.
Did you know how to work them out on the guitar?
Well, yeah. I don't know. Over the past 10 or 15 years, I've done a lot of transcribing of orchestra pieces to the guitar. I mean, I'll take Wagner or Handel or Bach and do little guitar arrangements of them sometimes.
How come?
Well, why not? It's it's just a kick to play those things, to play those pieces of music, and not having a big band at my disposal all the time. The guitar, I don't know. You just try to play what pieces of music you like on whatever instrument you've got, and do them as best you can.
Well, why don't we hear April in Paris from Alex Chilton's new CD, Set. That's April in Paris featuring Alex Shelton singing and on guitar from his new CD set. Now let me ask you about another song of yours. And the song is called In the Street. And this has actually become the theme song for the show, That 70s Show. And the current version of it that's used as a theme is performed by Cheap Trick. What do you know about how this song was chosen as the theme for the show?
A friend of mine from Philadelphia, or at least from right across the river, named Ben Vaughn, has been working in Hollywood doing music for various media productions, television, I guess, and movies for the past few years. And he somehow is working with the people who produced the show, The 70s Show. And they were looking for a theme, and he suggested this tune to them, and I guess that they liked it and thought it would work well, so that's how it happened.
Did you write it in the 70s?
I did, yeah.
And does the song say 70s to you?
I never thought about it actually as having to do with a period of time. I thought of it as having to do with sort of growing up suburban and being a teenager, more or less.
Would you play some of it for us?
Yeah, I'll play some of it for you.
So how old were you when you wrote that?
I guess I was 19 or 20.
So you weren't far removed from the character in the song?
True.
Smoking joints?
Of course.
The lyric is kind of rewritten for the TV show. I think there's nothing about the joint on it. And instead there are lyrics about Nixon's gone, but rock lives on.
Oh, really? You know, I've never watched the show. I've never heard them do it.
Well, at least that's on the CD version of the theme from the show. I'm not sure that it's actually on the TV version.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about them changing your lyric?
Oh, I don't care what they do.
Uh-huh. I guess you never really know what's going to happen to one of your songs.
Yeah, people can twist it any kind of way they want, I guess.
But, I mean, you never know, like, what use it's going to have.
That's true.
Yeah. Let me take...
I don't feel like it's a real desecration, though. You know, it's not a sacred object.
Right. My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Alex Chilton. His new CD of covers is called Set. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Once
My guest is singer-songwriter and guitarist Alex Chilton. He has a new CD called Set, featuring his covers of jazz, soul, and rock and roll recordings. Since you have your guitar with you, I wonder if you could play for us a song that you're currently really infatuated with, a song that you're just hearing in your head a lot now.
There's an old tune by a guy named Frederick Knight who's been kicking around the soul scene for a long time, and he's a producer and writer for Malico these days. And this is a tune of his that I remember, that I don't know if this thing ever really hit or anything. I just discovered it by accident, maybe in the early 70s. And I can't find the record anymore, so I had to rewrite the second verse on my own. I could only remember his first verse. But it's a song called Claim to Fame, and I think it's something I'm going to start doing with my band pretty soon. So, all right, Claim to Fame by Frederick Knight here.
As I saw you standing there with the wind blowing in your hair, I saw you with your wings on. Well, I guess I couldn't deny what I was feeling deep inside. Is this your claim to, is this your claim to fame? Is love your claim to fame? Well, don't be ashamed to call my name out loud. Yeah, is this your claim to fame? Is love your so fair? Is this your claim to fame? Is this your claim to fame? Ba 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 ba. Is love your claim to fame? Don't be ashamed to call my name out loud. Yeah. Is this your claim to fame? Is love your claim to fame?
I like it.
Anyway, it sort of goes like that.
I like the song. I never heard it before.
Nobody has but me. And, and I can't even find it to find the second verse of it, so I just had to write it myself.
So you think you'll be writing more songs again soon? Is that something you're hoping for?
I actually have been writing a lot this year, but I don't know. I don't know what of the over the last year I've been writing a lot. I haven't really done any discerning about it to see which ones among them are worth my doing at the moment.
How do you decide that?
Well, mostly what I've done in the last year is write sets of lyrics. And a lot of times I just look at a set of lyrics and have a general idea of what sort of music, what sort of thing it'll be, and I'll just leave the set of lyrics there. And sometimes I'll just let the thing kind of fall together around a very rudimentary concept in the studio, and that may be the way some of it happens, if and when I get around to recording some of them.
Let me play something else from your new CD set. And this is the Harry Warren, Mac Gordon song, There Will Never Be Another You. What inspired you to include this?
It's just something that we do now and then on stage. And one of the musicians said, hey, let's try another you. It wasn't something I'd planned. And so I counted it off a little too fast, and we did it. And it just worked.
What are your memories of this song? This song dates back to the 40s.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things that, I mean, when I was seven, my dad got a Chet Baker record, and really the first singer that ever caught me was Chet Baker, and I just loved his voice, and I sang along with his records, and it's a thing that I first heard Chet Baker do.
Well, good. Well, let's hear it. And this is There Will Never Be Another You from the new Alex Chilton CD set.
There will be many other nights like this, and I'll be standing here with someone new. There will be other songs to sing, another fall, another spring, but there will never be another you. There will be other lips that I may kiss, but they won't thrill me like yours used to do. Oh, I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true when there will never ever be another you?
Music from Alex Chilton's new CD, Set. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Maldonado, and Patty Leswing. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at REEL.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Inc.'s Dial Press Division, publisher of The Running Mate, a new novel of politics by Joe Klein, author of Primary Colors. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Writer Ted Conover wanted to investigate the prison system, so he spent a year as a guard at New York State's Sing Sing Prison. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about his new book, New Jack. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.